Welcome to the History of Language podcast, where we'll be going over the history of language from a base-up approach. We'll be talking about languages as they existed in history, our best understanding of languages that aren't attested but are understood from a research perspective, and make our way to the modern day. The structure of this show is fairly straightforward. Starting as far back with an ancient language as we can, we will make our way through the ages, through the various divisions of language families, and wend our way home to some of the languages spoken throughout the world today. Each episode should be fairly short, as I don't want to bore you with all of the linguistic bits and bobs, but hopefully prove informative enough to be useful. I do admit that I will use linguistic terminology, so I hope you have some understanding of linguistics, but I'll make sure to try and explain the more opaque concepts. My name is Clockwork, and I'll be your host. You may be wondering what makes me qualified to talk on this subject. I'm a linguist based out of California, and my areas of interest are historical linguistics, where I focus on pre-Old Norse, Old English, and Hawaiian, and language revitalization. As a history geek, in addition to being a language geek, when I found that historical linguistics is a field, naturally the pieces all fell together. In addition to being a language researcher, I am also a conlanger, or an inventor of languages. This unique perspective on language and language history really helps me to sink my teeth into the history of the world's languages, as you need to have that kind of understanding to create a realistic language. I hope that you enjoy your time with me as we take this path throughout time, because this is really my favorite subject in the field of linguistics, and having this as an outlet to share this knowledge is a great joy of mine. So let's get started. The topic of today's episode is the Proto-Indo-European language family. We as English speakers speak one language of this large and prestigious language family, and we will eventually reach our sliver of the language pie when we cover the Germanics. Allow me to set the stage for the speakers of this reconstructed mother tongue to so many of the world's languages. Unfortunately, precious little has survived from the time that the Indo-Europeans emerged onto the world stage. The furthest back that we can trace their language and culture is about 7,000 years ago, which places us in the late Neolithic Age, about the 4th millennium BCE, and the language likely would have been spoken until about 4,500 years ago, when the dialects would have started to diverge more greatly and become the earliest attested languages from Europe and Asia. We understand that these people came from the area of the Pontic-Caspian steppe, spreading outwards after they'd tamed horses and mastered the wheel. The Indo-Europeans were largely a pastoral people. They cultivated grains and cereals, and they farmed for their food. They also showed knowledge of animal husbandry, caring for cattle and sheep. Their language contained words for a snowy winter, so we know that they came from a region that had both warm summers and cold winters. We understand that they could cross not only large tracts of land with their wagons pulled by domesticated oxen, but cross bodies of water as well. They worshipped many different deities, with one standing out, the father god, Zeus Pachter, the sky god, which we find in its daughter languages as the Greek Zeus, Latin Jupiter, and the Sanskrit Deus Pita. Their society was likely to be patrilineal, meaning that relations amongst men were the predominant hierarchy. Their society likely had a caste system of priests, the warriors below them, and in turn the peasants below them. Their rulers were buried in kurgans, large and ornate burial mounds filled not only with their worldly possessions, but sometimes with their wives or members of their family who were offered as human sacrifice. The Proto-Indo-European language seems to be an incredibly complex language. It utilized both inflectional affixes, bits of meaning added to words to change the root meaning. For example, the suffix ly, added to sweet, turns the adjective sweet into an adverb sweetly. Hi. Clockwork here. In the demonstration of affixes in the original recording, I was a bit vague. The example I gave was actually a poor one to use in this case. I used a derivational affix when I should have used an inflectional affix, like the plural s that makes dog singular into dogs plural. Carry on, and thanks for listening. And oblaut, or a morphing of word stems to change the word. Think the English word man as singular to men. Plural. Because of its reliance on these processes to mark words' functions in a sentence, there likely wasn't a fixed word order, though research shows that an SOV, or subject-object-verb word order, was likely the default. The sound system, the phonology of Proto-Indo-European, is a part of the language subject to much heated debate. As such, I will present my general understanding of the sound system and attempt to explain what some of the major theories are surrounding each segment. Starting with the consonants, it's generally agreed upon that Proto-Indo-European had the nasals, M and N, so M, N. The voiceless stops, P, T, K, K, and Q. The voice stops, B, though exceedingly rare, D, G, G, and G. And the aspirated stops, B, D, G, G, and G. It also had the sibilant S, so S. It had the laryngeals, H1, H2, and H3, which we believe may have been the sounds H, H, and R. Unfortunately, there's no consensus as to how these actually sounded. It also had the liquids and semivowels, R, L, Y, and W. The rarity and near absence of the sound B is incredibly rare in any spoken language today, and we find the sound in, to my knowledge, every single daughter language of Proto-Indo-European. However, we don't find many roots with an initial B, and the ones with the B in the medial position appear only in Western Proto-Indo-European roots. Some researchers posit a change from M in certain circumstances that gave rise to B. Additionally, the consonant cluster PH3, so P, frequently gave rise to B. For example, the Proto-Indo-European bibreti to the Sanskrit bibati, to drink. There's also some disagreement as to the pronunciation of the K and G stops. Perhaps the plain K, G, and G were regular velar stops, pronounced with the tongue touching the velum. Perhaps the quote-unquote palatal K, G, and G were the truly plain velars K, G, and G, and the quote-unquote plain and labialized velars were actually uvular stops, so K, G, G, and G, as well as G, and G. We're not sure which, but I personally prefer the former analysis, not least of which because it's easier for me to pronounce. As mentioned earlier, Proto-Indo-European is likely to be a very complex language, but we can break down its words and the parts that build them into two pieces. We have the root, the base form of a word, which can change directly through oblaut, and very rarely would you find one of these on their own. It lacks context, and more information than just the base meaning or base concept would need to be conveyed. These base words were used to convey their concepts, but also were used to derive other related words. We also have the affix, a bit of additional information added to a root that changes its meaning. Usually, it would be these added onto roots to give them actual meaning. Nouns in Proto-Indo-European decline for 8 or 9 cases depending on who you ask. Personally, I agree with the 8-class camp, but on the basis of symmetry, I entertain the idea that it had 9 classes, and I'll explain in a moment. Those classes are the nominative, the subject of a sentence, or the one performing an action, the accusative, the direct object of a sentence, or the one an action is performed upon, the genitive, a possessor or something modifying another noun, the dative, the indirect object of a verb, for example, John, in I gave John the book, the instrumental case, the object or means by which the subject completes a task, the ablative, expressing motion away from something, the locative, marking the location of something, such as English in, at, on, or by, the vocative, directly addressing someone, for example, the difference between I don't know John, meaning I am not acquainted with John, and I don't know John, meaning that I do not know and I am addressing John in particular. The vocative is used frequently in a religious setting in modern languages, for example, O God in English and the Russian Bozhe Moi, meaning roughly my God, or in a bit more flowery language and slightly more accurately, O God of mine. It also potentially had the allative case, which marks movement towards something. However, only the Anatolian language of ancient Turkey had this noun case, but because there is the ablative case, marking movement away from something, it's possible for this case to have existed as symmetry, though an independent development for this is not out of the question. As well, there were 3 grammatical genders, and before we talk about them, I have to dispel a misconception about grammatical gender. Grammatical gender is a misnomer. A more accurate way to name this phenomenon is a noun class. Grammatical gender does not assign gender in any way to the object it describes. It is just that when early grammarians came up with the terminology, they believed that these noun classes are as innate to the language as gender is to humans, although we know that their thoughts on gender were antiquated as well, and that discussion falls out of the purview of this show. There are some languages that have a specific human gender marking in them, for example the English third-person singular pronouns he and her. As well, Arabic and Hebrew both have different forms for whether you're speaking to a man or a woman. Back to the topic at hand, the three genders present in Proto-Indo-European are as follows: the masculine, feminine, and neuter. Anyone who's studied Latin, German, Russian, or some dialects of Norwegian will already be familiar with this three-way split between noun classes. Many languages descended from Proto-Indo-European have lost one or all of these divisions. Spanish and French, for example, only retain the masculine and feminine genders from Latin. English has lost the gendered system entirely. Proto-Indo-European had personal pronouns, like the English I, me, you, and so on. However, the reconstruction of them is difficult due to the extreme variation amongst Proto-Indo-European's daughter languages. However, they can be reconstructed as such. The nominative first-person singular, heg, hegyo, or hegyohom. The first-person plural, we. The second-person singular, tu. The second-person plural, you. The accusative first-person singular, hme, or hme. The first-person plural, nisme, or nos. The second-person singular, tue. And the second-person plural, usme, or wos. The genitive first-person singular, hmene, or hmoi. The first-person plural, niso, nisero, or nos. The second-person singular, tewe, or toi. And the second-person plural, yuso, yusero, or wos. The dative first-person singular, meihyo, or moi. The first-person plural, nisme, or nus. The second-person singular, tevhyo, or toi. And the second-person plural, usme. The instrumental first-person singular, moi. The instrumental first-person plural, nismoi. The second-person singular, toi. And the second-person plural, usmoi. The ablative first-person singular, med. The first-person plural, nismed. The second-person singular, tued. And the second-person plural, usmed. Finally, the locative, the first-person singular, moi. First-person plural, nismi. Second-person plural, toi. And second-person plural, usmi. Proto-Indo-European didn't have third-person personal pronouns, instead using demonstrative pronouns like that. Proto-Indo-European verbs changed their forms very much like their nominal counterparts, meaning that they had a system of ablaut. Proto-Indo-European verbs exhibited three aspects: the stative, depicting a state of being; the imperfective, a form that shows an action as being incomplete, in the process of completion, and actions undergone habitually. As well, it had the perfective, a form that shows a completed action or the entire process of actions. They also had three grammatical moods: the indicative, expressing a statement of fact; the imperative, a command; the subjunctive, expressing an unreal state like a wish, possibility, or an opinion; and the optative, explicitly showing a wish or a hope, which is closely related to the subjunctive. The verbs had two grammatical voices: active, where the subject is the same as the verb's agent or initiator, and the medio-passive, encompassing both the middle voice, a construction that's hard to convey in English, but sometimes is used for reflexes, like the boy washes himself, and the passive voice, where the agent of a verb is omitted. Verbs also agree with their subjects for person and number. The first, second, and third person, so I, you, or they do X. The singular, dual, and plural numbers, so exactly one entity, exactly two entities, or more than two entities. Proto-Indo-European numbers were a base 10 system, and are generally reconstructed as from 1 through 10, 1, hoino or sem, 2, duo, 3, tre or tri, 4, quetur or quetur, 5, penque, 6, suecis, 7, septum, 8, octo or octo, or hecto or hecto, 9, neun, and 10, decimt. Now that that's out of the way, let's get to the fun part, Schleicher's fable. This was the first text composed in Proto-Indo-European and was published in 1868 by August Schleicher, who called it Avis Akvasas Ka, the sheep and the horses. Schleicher's original fable went, Avis, jasmin varna naast, la darka akvan stam, vagham garum vagantam, tam, baram magam, tam, manum aku, barantam. Avis akvabjam sa vavakat, card agnutai mai vidanti manum akvans agantam. Akvasas avavakant, crudi avai, card agnutai vividvans vas, manus patis varnam avisam skarnauti, svabjam garmam vastram, avibjans kavarna naasti. Tat kukruvans avis agram abugat. Or in Schleicher's German, it would be das Schaf und die Rose. Ein Schaf, auch welchem wolle nicht war ein geschorenes Schaf sah Rosa, das einen schweren Wagen fahrend, das eine große Last, das einen Menschen schnell tragend. Das Schaf sprach zu den Rosen, das Herz wird bängen mir, es tut mir herzlich leid, sehen den Menschen die Rose treiben. Die Rose sprachen, höre Schaf, das Herz wird bängen in den gesehen haben, es tut uns herzlich leid, da wir wissen, der Mensch, der Herr macht die Wolle der Schafe zu einem warmen Kleide für sich und den Schafen ist nicht Wolle, die Schafe aber haben keine Wolle mehr, sie werden geschoren, es geht ihnen noch schlechter als den Rosen. Dies gehört haben Borg entwich das Schaf auf das, dies gehört haben Borg entwich das Schaf auf das Feld, es machte sich aus dem Staube. Or in English, on a hill, a sheep that had no wool saw horses, one of them pulling a heavy wagon, one carrying a big load, and one carrying a man quickly. The sheep said to the horses, my heart pains me seeing a man driving horses. The horses said, listen, sheep, our hearts pain us when we see this, a man, the master, makes the wool of the sheep into a warm garment for himself, and the sheep has no wool. Having heard this, the sheep fled into the plain. And finally, in our current understanding of Proto-Indo-European, chois hekiosque. Chaue hiosme hulnach nehest, so hekwums dirkt. So gwurhum wohum weged, so wehem borum, so degmonum chokjubered, chois hekwobios weuket, dihemonum specioch hekwumsque hageti, ger moi agnutor. Hekios tu weukond, Kliudhi chowe, tod specio mes nsme agnutor ger, dikiemo potis, se chauies chulnach, guermom westrom wept, chauivios tu chulnacht nehesti. Tod kiekiluos, chauis chagirom buged. Thank you for listening to the History of Language podcast. I hope you enjoyed running through the minds and mouths of the Indo-Europeans as much as I did. The next branches of Indo-European languages that we'll cover include the Germanic languages, the Celtic languages of mainland Europe and the British Isles, the Hellenic languages of Greece, the Italic languages of Italy, the Slavic languages of Eastern Europe, and finally, the Indo-Aryan languages from the Indian subcontinent. Next week, we'll begin to explore Common Germanic, the language that gave rise to modern English, German, Dutch, Norwegian, Swedish, and Icelandic. In the weeks following, we'll work our way to the modern Indo-European languages, then after that, the Uralic, Kartvelian, Afro-Asiatic, Northern Asian, Sino-Tibetan, Austronesian, Iroquoian, and Uto-Aztecan languages. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.